From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Another one bites the dust. Another good woman in a heterosexual relationship lost to the Mrs. Machine. Are you a theatre gal at heart?
No, I don't believe I am. I find it too terrifying.
My surname is actually McDonough now, because I fell in love with a Galway boy, married him, and so Galway's my home now.
Coming up on this Deeper in Debt edition of Playback Daily, the Mrs. Machine, how you can avoid getting caught up in it. The Irish acting dynasty still ruling the boards. And meeting Ireland's first ever patisserie champion. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that really fancies a pan au raisin right now for some reason. Let's kick things off with Oliver Callan, who began his morning monologue by referencing an article by Áine Kenny in today's Irish Times, which questions the motivations of what she calls the Mrs. Machine.
Áine Kenny, writing in today's Irish Times, is questioning why women keep changing their surnames to match their husbands in this day and age, in Annam J, as you say. So what happened to her? Again, she's looking at Instagram. Someone likes a post. She doesn't recognise the name. She's fussy about who does this. So she's going, why don't I know this? But oh, it's actually that nice girl who's in my class in school. Why has she got a different name? She just got married and changed her last name. Despite not knowing why she's changed her surname to match her new husband's, I can't help but feel a little sad, says Áine. Another one bites the dust. Another good woman in a heterosexual relationship lost to the Mrs. Machine. And she goes on to cite research. 79% of women, according to American research, take their husband's name. 5% went for the double-barreled option. 92% of men keep their last names. Only 5% change them. And less than 1% of men hyphenate their name with their partner's last name. And she's kind of talking about the LGBT couples. Their approach is more, there's more equality there, isn't there? In the small studies, the majority keep their own name. Some do the double barrel thing. Of course, in this country, very few, as we know from the anniversary last week, only 6,000 same-sex marriages in 10 years, or 20,000 weddings a year in Ireland. So it's a very, very small number. Honestly, it's clear that women changing their surnames after marriage to men is still an extremely common practice. Some think it's a harmless tradition. I can't get past the symbolic misogyny. Originally, the bride's father was giving her away to a new husband, and she says the practice is first noted in the Church of England's Book of Common Prayer from the 16th century. The bride becomes the husband's property, so she takes his surname after marriage. The idea is codified in English common law, known as coverture, where the married woman became legally dead once they became married and instead becomes one with their husband. Legally dead, and into the Mrs. Machine you go. People often thought her own parents, because her mum kept her own name, thought her own parents were divorced because they had different names. So you can't really win. Modern marriage, she says, should be about unity and equality. And for me, changing my surname to my husband's would never make me feel like an equal. And that's why she is Áine Kenny still, the name she was born with, and she is married. If changing one's name isn't a big deal and it isn't sexist, why don't we see more men taking their wife's surname? Or they go double-barreled. It is very, very rare. I often hear women worrying if they don't change their name, they won't have the same surname as their children. It's a valid concern, but why are we automatically giving children their father's surname? I wish my parents had given me a double-barreled name. And this is what happens in Spain, she says, where every person has a double-barreled surname derived from their mother and father, which seems like a fair thing. And then they get married themselves, and rather than having four names, one has to get dropped. And that's always the... So it was the maternal end, isn't it? But I'm beginning to hear also of another option. This is new. The couple choosing a brand new surname that they can both take. Sometimes it's an amalgamation of their existing names or a totally new name. And she knows someone who took the name of their a beloved holiday spot. So she's trying to, she might, jokingly, she says, she'll have to convince her husband that Áine Athens has a nice ring to it.
But when the child of Trent Alexander-Arnold and the child of Julia Louis-Dreyfus get married, what do they do then? Jaden Louis Dreyfus Alexander Arnold. I mean, where will it end? Well, at least in Disneyland, you don't have that problem because Mickey and Minnie already have the same surnames, even though they're not married. And the most popular character in the merch store doesn't have a surname at all.
Yeah, that's the blue alien Stitch. And the live-action remake of the 2002 Lilo and Stitch animated film is the number one movie everywhere in the world. It was also number one in the Irish box office. It made €1 million over the weekend. So people are still going to the cinema here when it's a big event. And it's a story about a bond between a lonely six-year-old Hawaiian girl and her extraterrestrial pet Stitch. But they don't think it's an alien because she adopts him from a dog shelter after he crash-landed on Earth. And he's an adorable little fella, and there's lots of nice Hawaiian type Polynesian music in the film, the original one that is, and the new film is a massive hit, and the surprise on the merch and the franchise front is because Stitch has been kind of dormant for most of the 2000s, and quietly Stitch has grown in popularity with huge swathes of consumers, and they say in this New York Times piece reading this morning, it's because he's nationless, raceless and ageless, so everybody loves him and there's no division at all. The Disney Stitch Puppetronic is an 18-inch electronic puppet, has been named the 2025 Toy of the Year. The Americans are usually ahead of us in this, but the marketing and the attention this is going to get will put Stitch in many's the Santi letter by the end of the year. The market is everyone from 7 years up. Now, they expected mostly 7 to 10 being the market for Stitch merch, but instead they're finding consumers 13 and older, Gen Z enthusiasts, they're in their 20s, and middle-aged collectors are responsible for 40% of all the sales of Stitch. Younger consumers, the gender breakdown is evenly split, which is very interesting, and it's rare for a character to be evenly split among the genders. That is, older fans tend to skew more female, so Stitch is now up there with the Star Wars and Moana and the whole lot of them. It's a cash cow for Disney. They love him, he's cute, but he's also a spreadsheet king and a key performance indicator, which does tell you this is the sad corporate reality behind all this cuddly fantasy fun.
Sounds like the sort of phrase you'd see on a niche dating platform, doesn't it? Cuddly fantasy fun. Or is that just me? Okay, moving on. When you go to Disneyland, do you use your credit card to pay for those $25 fries? That's a sign of the new credit crunch that people who know about these things tell us is on the way. Oliver has the stats.
Americans are now, they owe a record on their credit cards. They've never had such credit card debt. It is $1.2 trillion. Despite that, spending is increasing all of the time. It basically means that spending is ramping up. Even people don't have the money, but they kind of think they will have the money, and they're not preparing for shocks like something in the wider economy, like, say, a tariff war or being let go from the jobs because there are rolling redundancies everywhere. You don't get redundancy payments in America. And they say credit card delinquency rates remain elevated. It's not paying, basically. What a lovely term, credit card delinquency. The uptick, as they say in America, could indicate borrowers are having some difficulty repaying, according to the research. And now they're seeing this new phenomenon of takeaway delivery companies offering an eat now, pay later offer. So DoorDash is what they have in America. They've done a deal with the Swedish pay later company Klarna, and it's fueling concerns around loans, essentially loans for takeout in America. The food delivery app and the installment lenders say they're offering a flexible alternative to the high interest credit cards. But social media users and advocates in the financial world say this is a sign of very hard times if people can't even pay for their takeaway delivery. In Ireland, the version which the Journal and now the Irish Independent are reporting is being launched with Deliveroo and Klarna together, raising concerns of running up debt. Charlie Weston writing, Klarna says its payment option is interest-free, but it admitted that missed payments could incur fees. Unpaid debts might result in debt collectors being engaged. And the Consumers Association of Ireland said that there's a risk people will end up in debt after ordering fast food and using Klarna to pay for it. And a particular problem for young people, well, for nearly every demographic, renting in Ireland, because the level of their income they spend on rent these days, it's pretty scary, isn't it? Klarna says Irish consumers have spent €1.3 billion on credit cards to buy groceries and other perishables, food that is, in 2023. So only half of the consumers pay the minimum amount each week, which would take 20 years to pay off the credit card debt. They're saying the alternative. They are the alternative. Consumers are given the option to pay with a high interest credit card. They should have the option, which we give, of interest-free 60-day buy now, pay later. That's their argument. Now, back in America, advocacy group saying, making four payments to pay for your tacos on a Tuesday night sounds complicated, because it is. I wouldn't characterise this as a solution, says this group. It's a fintech innovation that creates problems. And in America, people will risk additional overdraft fees from their banks. A fellow with a money advisory firm, which is focused on the millennials, that's anyone from late 20s up to 40, into their 40s, wrote online last week, if you need to borrow to have a burrito delivered to you, you are the product, nothing more.
You also should maybe reconsider whether you actually need that burrito delivered to your door, or whether you could rustle up something a little cheaper and slightly less convenient. That's the monologue from this morning's Oliver Callan in four easy listen installments for your delectation. That'll be €160, please. Now, if you're a student or you have one in the family who's thinking of applying to a US university, you may want to delete your social media account profiles first, as the American president appears to have directed authorities to scour applicants' social media for any posts that may be deemed offensive to his orange sensibilities. This morning, Claire Byrne spoke to Stephen Erlanger, the New York Times' chief diplomatic correspondent covering Europe, and asked him to outline what the leaked changes are likely to be.
The State Department, which is in charge of providing visas for everybody, has put a hold on international student applications until it's claimed there's more digging into their social media programs. Now, the problem is the consular officials don't have the time to do this, and it would depend, obviously, on an applicant being willing to open up their social media, presumably. And so whatever happens, it's going to slow things down terribly. It's also deeply political on the part of the Trump administration.
But we don't know from that leaked memo or cable what they're going to be looking for in those social media profiles.
No, that's true. But I mean, we can guess. What we can guess is any form of support for Hamas, for instance, or what the Trump people have decided in a very broad way would be anti-Semitism, which could include support for Palestinians inside Gaza. It could include, obviously, worries about terrorism that have nothing to do with Gaza. It could have to do with what the Trump people consider woke thought, or even sharp criticism of Mr. Trump and his officials. It could be any of those things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the fear, you know, and you hear it here in Ireland with all of those students who had been hoping to go over for the summer, that they're concerned, well, do I have a meme on my phone about Donald Trump? Will that mean that I'm turned away at the border? And we simply don't know, Stephen. Isn't that where we're at this morning?
Yes, and I think it's a legitimate fear. I mean, we don't know what they're looking for. I'm sure the consular officials who are, you know, professionals aren't going to go nuts, but it would be very, very time consuming. And also part of it, it's designed to hurt elite institutions that these students want to attend. I mean, that's part of what the Trump people are doing. They're making, in a way, an attack on elite institutions, on Ivy League schools that they consider are somehow against Trump or are somehow havens of left-wing, woke, anti-Semitic thought.
Mm-hmm. And that will have a big financial impact on those institutions, because these students coming from overseas tend to pay very high fees for their education, don't they?
Well, they do. And for example, Harvard, where I went, so I feel very strongly about this. I mean, Harvard has a large number of international students, which improve the learning for everybody. And also, many of them do pay the full weight of tuition, which is quite high, while many of the American students get scholarship aid or financial aid of some kind. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is meant to hurt those institutions also.
And what are you hearing about, as a former Harvard student, about this pressure on Harvard and how it is impacting the institution, the people who work there and the people who study there?
Well, it's having a big impact because the government, as you know, has a lot of power. Harvard gets a lot of federal grants, which they compete for, very often for medical research or sociological research, and a lot of those have been put on hold. Probably the most damaging thing that's been aimed at Harvard is taking away its ability to apply for visas for overseas students. Now, that's directly aimed at Harvard. Trump's in a war with them, and they are refusing to give in to everything that Trump wants. And clearly, he and his officials are trying to bring Harvard to heel.
Mm-hmm. And it is fighting back, though, Harvard. I mean, they've taken a case against the administration, which is pending. Isn't that right?
Well, they've taken several lawsuits against the administration on any number of issues. And yes, some of them are pending. Some of them have been stayed temporarily by judges, you know, for further hearing. But it is very difficult for any institution, no matter how wealthy or important mm-hmm. or old, to stand up against the government of the United States, which has many, many ways to attack them.
Well, you're exactly right. And Harvard, you could argue, has the means currently to fight back. But there are many other universities that probably can't withstand this level of attack and don't have the financial firepower to push back.
Yes, I think that's true. But it also must be seen as part of the Trump administration's political aim, which is maybe recognizable from Britain, which is protect the borders, keep out all kinds of migrants without them being fully checked. I mean, this is part of Trump's political line, and this is one more example of it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the administration says it's tackling the failure of these universities to root out anti-Semitism. How is that justification being viewed?
Well, I think it's totally instrumentalized. I mean, it is totally instrumentalized. It's not like there wasn't some anti-Semitism, and a lot of it was simply aimed at people horrified by the deaths in Gaza and the long length of this war. And maybe these institutions, and probably, you know, they will admit they didn't do enough to protect their own Jewish students from harassment. But this is instrumentalizing this to the point where many Jewish organizations are very, very angry about the way they're being misused for Trump's own political ends.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have a view on this, but there will be many parents in Ireland listening to this whose third level student is planning to go over to the United States for the summer on a J1. It's a tradition here where you go over and you work for the summer, or you have, you know, a good life experience. They're really worried about this. Should they be?
Well, I think they should plunge ahead, to be honest. If anything, there will be delays. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty. We haven't seen the whole document. We don't know how it's going to work. I would take a chill pill a bit and take a breath. It is a great country to study in and be part of. I had many Irish friends myself there. And I mean, think about it, but panic is the last thing I would recommend. Mm-hmm.
The New York Times' chief diplomatic correspondent covering Europe, Stephen Erlanger, advising Irish students to panic in advance of their planned trips to the US this summer. Well, panic when all else fails is possibly a more accurate reflection of what he said, to be fair, when he was talking to Claire Byrne this morning. Hawaiian native and adopted daughter of Galway, Asia Mahilani is Ireland's first ever patisserie champion. The pastry chef, having trained in one of the top gastronomic schools in Paris, was crowned champion yesterday, and she spoke to Ray Darcy this afternoon.
We had overall about six hours of cooking in the kitchen, and for the first round we presented Café Gourmandise, so the treat that's beside you there. We had a lot of rules to follow. It was plant-based. We used Be Better Butter. Make something that people can eat with a coffee.
Yes.
Very easy, accessible.
What is that again? Just name it again.
So I named it the Gaelic Lan.
No, but it's a type of what?
Café Gourmandise.
Right.
So just a little pastry.
Yeah.
It's but a fancy way of saying like a little coffee pastry.
A coffee pastry.
Yeah.
It's so perfect.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's so, like, that is just, I don't want to eat that. It's too good to eat. That is too good to eat. So that was the first thing.
Yeah, that was the first thing. Then the next round, we presented plated desserts like you would see in a restaurant. And that had some other rules, but it didn't need to be plant-based, just guidelines. And we had to use a Grand Cru chocolate from Valrhona, which is usually single origin, which they work very closely with the chocolate producer, which is really cool because...
It's fair trade. Is it fair?
I don't know if it's fair trade, but it'd be really direct with the producer.
Okay.
And there's a lot of disparities between like the chocolate producer and then the chocolate eater. But they work to even like help build healthcare like facilities and things like that. But anyway, that's off track.
But it's something you're passionate about.
Yeah, I majored in food systems, actually. So I learned about like the whole food system from agriculture through consumption and like the politics and theories surrounding that and all that jazz. I'm a big nerd myself, so right. as you kind of got a gist of earlier. But yeah, we had the plated desserts then, brought it up to the judges, just like showed them, explained it a bit. And then we had another hour or so afterwards to finish a chocolate showpiece. So a big artistic display made completely out of chocolate.
How big was it?
It needs to be at least 60 centimeters.
So yeah. you're holding it. That's about 3 foot, 2.5, 3 foot there.
Maybe two
yes.
and a half, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Which is, yeah, very nerve-wracking because as like in the TV shows, you know, it can all fall and crumble. So that's the nerve-wracking part. But
Congratulations. Now, people may have copped that you're not from Ireland.
Yeah.
you've taken a very circuitous route to be with us today.
Yeah.
Starting in Hawaii, no less.
Yeah, I'm originally from Hawaii.
Hawaii. That's how you say it, is it?
Hawaii.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. But Hawaii's fine.
Okay.
And my surname is actually McDonough now because I fell in love with a Galway boy, married him, and so Galway's my home now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you meet?
I was on a road trip with my sister in Ireland, and we had one night in Galway, and I met him in a pub.
Right.
So I met him, but we were leaving the next day to continue our road trip, and initially when we parted, he said, you know, have a nice life, and I was like, all right, thanks, you too. And then he texted me like an hour later. I was like, I want to see you again, so... He took a day off and took the bus to Dublin to catch us before. I was living in Paris at the time, working in pastry. And he ended up moving to Paris 6 weeks later to be with me. So the third time I'd seen him, we moved in together.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very fast.
Yes.
We committed very fast, but it'll be 7 years in August. So it worked out.
Yeah. Have a good life.
Yeah. I do, actually. So.
Look, there's a lovely movie in that, isn't there?
Yeah, it does feel like kind of like a romantic.
Yeah. Are you a romantic person?
I am. And I actually make wedding cakes now. So it's really fun for me to like hear everybody else's love stories, get to know them and what they want to like feel and express on their big days. And then, you know, kind of relive that beginning of the...
Yeah, tap into it.
Yeah. I mean, it's still really lovely with me and my husband. We're still in that honeymoon phase. But, you know, get to hear all the love stories. It's really fun. And then to try and create a pastry, a sweet treat to go along with it and bring them a little bit more joy on that day is like, yeah, it's really lovely.
Yeah, what a lovely thing to do.
It is.
That is a joyous day for nearly everybody, isn't it?
Yeah.
The wedding day. It's that one day.
Yeah. And everybody in the wedding industry is really happy, which was kind of new. I've worked in pastry shops and restaurants for 10 years and not everyone's always happy. So it's really nice to see everybody like really. Yeah.
And baking was always going to be something you were going to do because your grandmother was the bread woman on the island.
Yeah, she's bread lady on Maui.
Right.
So, yeah.
What's the population of Maui?
I actually don't know.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
okay.
I don't know.
I thought you'd know it. You've been a nerd and all that, but
it's changed a lot since I was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot different now.
So she was getting up at what time in the morning?
4 in the morning. Right. Yeah. So she'd wake us up when we'd stay over, just to have, not like forcefully or anything, just to have fun in the kitchen and help her. But it was so lovely to like wake up, like roll down the stairs, and immediately you're just hit with beautiful, comforting aromas of freshly baked bread, sugar, and cinnamon.
Yeah, I was with you until the cinnamon, but you lost me there. Oh well. Pastry chef Asia Mahilani, Ireland's first ever patisserie champion, talking romance and pastry with Ray Darcy this afternoon. The legendary Irish acting dynasty known as the Cusacks, because, well, that's their name, has been a force in theatre, TV and film since Patriarch Cyril joined the Abbey Players in 1932. Soraka Cusack is visiting these shores, she lives in England, with a new stage show, and she popped into studio to chat to Oliver Callan this morning.
Was there a production, because you were there for quite long TV productions, beloved shows, was there one that you go, oh my God, yes, I loved my time on that?
On television?
Yeah.
Not really.
No?
No. I mean, you know, Father Brown was very nice, easy, and it started off very well written, I think, and the yeah, the standard was very good.
It's hard to keep it sustained.
You know, it's not... The real challenges are always going to be maybe in film and theatre most.
Are you a theatre gal at heart?
No, I don't believe I am. I find it too terrifying.
Oh, right, okay. And theatre people say they don't find the TV terrifying because they've only the couple of takes to get it right. Whereas they can change
yes,
it each night.
There's a lot of pressure, but I started very young. I started in RTE.
Oh, yeah.
As I came in, I thought, oh my God, I started here doing little Irish language programmes called Lower Gael Galin.
Oh.
And I would have been about 17, 15, 16.
Wow.
So that's where I started. So I learned an awful lot doing those kind of very, very basic programmes. But theatre is wonderful and I love going to the theatre. But it's a big challenge being on the other side of the lights.
Yeah. Have you been to the theatre here lately?
I have.
Oh, you have, yeah.
I went to see Love Song the other night. Good. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it. I'm down to see it.
Very good.
It's in the gate for
it's in the gate.
A while, isn't it?
I'm not sure what their dates are. It's it's lovely and a fantastic cast and well worth a go.
And you have that nice relief of sitting in the audience and not...
Yes.
I have a kind of a panic looking up at them, even though I've only done one theatre thing ever for like a couple of nights, of going, how are they going to do? And you kind of, I have the fear of what if something goes wrong? And
that's very empathetic.
or slightly mad. Tell us about the play you're doing, because this is the scary one, Escaped Alone.
Yes.
Carol Churchill. I don't think we're hugely familiar in Ireland, but she's a huge name in theatre in Britain. And still around, she's in her mid-80s.
She is.
This is something she wrote, I think, in her 70s.
Exactly.
Well, why don't I shut up and let you tell?
Well, I think that's very pertinent because the four characters, all women, are all, she stipulates, at least 70. Some people are more 70 than others.
They're the notes. Okay.
And she's a very particular writer, very brilliant, but it's not an easy one to give you a beginning, middle and end story.
I see.
It's a bit like, you know, rubbing your tummy and tapping your head because you're doing two things at the same time. It's three women on a sunny afternoon in my character's backyard having a cup of tea, talking about the grandchildren, the children, the relations, the local high street, what they've seen on television. But that is not the whole story, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Because the fourth character kind of invites herself in.
Okay, yeah.
And she prompts kind of the underlying tensions that exist.
What they're not talking about.
Correct.
Very good.
I don't know if you experience that, but I certainly have friends. There are some subjects I won't go near for fear it could cause... A rupture, I suppose.
Sour the mood.
You sour the mood. But even worse than that, and I think this catalyst prompts the cracks to open up and you see how the women deal with it. And I think the idea, because Mrs. Jarrett, who comes in, she brings really the weight of the catastrophes that are surrounding us.
Right.
Literally. Climate, tsunamis, wars, inhumanity, the whole lot.
Starvation, the thing we thought we'd solved.
Indeed. Absolutely. It's unbearable.
Decades ago.
Yeah.
And there are quite funny moments, aren't there? It's a dark humour.
Everyone says this, and I'm not going to try and sell it as a rip-roaring comedy. There are. Just the foibles of people, I suppose. But the women, it does rupture things, but it's how they deal with it. And it doesn't rupture the friendship, because you see that there are always two ways of looking at something. Both might be right. Neither might be right. But the important thing is, for them, the friendship is more important and survives.
They need each other.
Exactly.
Okay, but the apocalypse is unfurling all around. Now, is it kind of slightly set in the future? Are these apocalypses
happening? It's set in no time, really.
Okay.
But the concerns are very, very much those of today.
Okay, so it speaks to us right now.
I hope.
So are you looking forward to it?
I am and I amn't.
Is it hard work every day? What rehearsing will you do today, for instance?
Oh, I certainly will. We're having our first stagger through, I think it's called.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So that'll be very revealing. Yeah.
It could be nerve-wracking when you're kind of thinking, how will I get to the, when it's just flowing? But you've been there plenty of times before, you know what you're doing.
This is what we hope.
The messages are coming in already about your sisters, because, of course, there's lots of Cusack acting sisters, and about your dad. Can I ask about your mum, first of all? Because I had the pleasure of chatting to your brother, Pádraig, who's the producer. He was in the National Theatre for a couple of years, wasn't he, in London? And there was a T.G. Cahir documentary, which was gorgeous. But your mother's story is incredible. Maureen.
Cusack. Maureen Keeley, born in Glenties, lived in Derry. But she and her five siblings, there were six of them, the youngest was two, and both her parents died within 1 year. And she would have been about 15 or 16.
Yeah.
And they survived. They were so stoical and courageous, I think. She died very young at the age of 56
terrible,
in 1977.
Yeah.
And she still kind of is a massive influence in my heart.
Is that right?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, she kept the show on the road, because Cyril, obviously, as he said himself, you know, my dressing room was my home, and I think it was.
That sounds awful too, doesn't it? That's where he was happiest, or was where
he
was most comfortable?
I think so. But it's really interesting, looking back again from being the age I am, I could see why they met and joined each other, because in a way he was an orphan as well. And he kind of created himself, and he was a creation. And she supported that and kept us all going.
And she had all these talents. Was she brilliant piano? Did she teach piano?
No, she did not. She was an actress.
She was an actress as well.
And I don't like to say this. What we have on film or tape, she wasn't very good in those. But I think she was wonderful on stage, because she had this kind of innocence and just sweetness and kindness and warmth.
Oh, I like that doesn't take away from your view of her, obviously.
Not at all.
Very neutrally.
Yeah, not at all. It's far less important.
That's Saoirse Cusack dissing her mother's acting ability and talking this morning to Oliver Callan about her new play, Escaped Alone, which is at the Everyman Theatre in Cork from the 12th of June and the Project Arts Centre in Dublin from the 19th of June. Back on Today with Clare Byrne, on the topic of Ireland missing its mandatory emissions targets, was in the news again, leading Clare to talk to Diarmaid Tourney, director of the DCU Centre for Climate and Society, about, well, how we're screwing things up and we'll have to pay dearly for it.
The target for emissions reduction by 2030, which is just 5 years away now, this is set in Irish law. It's 51%. And last year, the EPA said we could achieve a 29% reduction. Today, it's just 23%, and that's the very best case scenario. So we're going backwards.
That's right, Claire, and it makes for a depressing reading. So each year, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is tasked with producing these projections of how our emissions are going to look over the coming period. This year, they're projecting out to 2055 in total. And they make those predictions based on a set of assumptions around things like population growth, economic growth, technology development, and so forth. But they also look closely at government policies. And they project emissions for different sectors based on the policies that the governments are already implementing and that the government have said they will implement. And as you said in your introduction, unfortunately, the numbers are really going in the wrong direction. So we've moved from last year a projected reduction of 28% to this year projected reduction of 23%, so moving in the wrong direction.
Okay, and we'll talk about the different sectors in a moment that are the culprits here, if you like. But for many people, the issue of the EU fines is the really big worry, because we're talking tens of billions of euro payable at some time in the near future, post 2030. How would they work and how much would they be?
Yes. So there are two sets of obligations, if you like. There's the under national legislation, our legally binding obligations, but there's also EU targets and then a compliance mechanism for if member states, including Ireland, don't meet those EU targets. And essentially how that works is that at EU level, member states agree to divide up the total reduction effort among themselves, and then when we come to the end of the period, so these targets are for 2030, the countries, the member states that over-comply, that's do better than their targets, can sell that over-compliance to member states that under-comply. Mm-hmm. And on these projections, Ireland is going to be under-complying. That's missing the target by nearly half. So our 2030 target under this EU legislation is a 42% reduction. Now, it's for a slightly, it's calculated on a slightly different basis. That's why it's not 51. But the EPA are projecting today that our reduction will be 22%, not 42%. And we don't know what the cost will be, because it's essentially a market. So there'll be buyers and sellers for these compliance credits. But we know that the amounts will be large. So in a report late last year, the Climate Change Advisory Council and the Fiscal Advisory Council together published a report that estimated the compliance cost could be in the region of 8 to 26 billion euro.
Right. And I mean, the reality of this, when you speak about the market here for the credits, is that we could be handing over our hard-earned cash to the good boys in Europe who have managed to meet their targets. Is that what it might look like?
That's it, yes. So this would be a transfer of money between member states. And the EU is projecting as a whole that the EU will meet the 2030 target. So there will be countries over-complying and other countries under-complying. And we really have a choice here in Ireland. We can either invest that money here in Ireland in things that reduce emissions and make lives better, or we can miss our targets and pay that money to other member states.
Okay, and when we look at the different areas then who are really having a difficult time achieving their targets, we see industry, transport and buildings as the ones that have been highlighted by the EPA. Maybe if we look at transport first, because people will remember the aim to get a million electric cars and vehicles on the road. We're going to miss that, clearly.
That's right. So in today's projections, the EPA are saying that if all planned government policies are implemented, the best we can do in the transport sector is a 21% reduction. And so with that 51% target, the government has divided it up into different numbers for each sector. And so the transport sectoral emission ceiling, so that's the target for the transport sector, is 50%. And the EPA are saying that we'll get get at best a 21% reduction. So like not even halfway there.
Okay. And when it comes to buildings then, what are the big problems facing buildings?
Yeah, so the picture is fairly similar. So the building sector is divided into residential homes and then commercial. And the really big problem is on the residential side. So the target for that sector is a 40% reduction, and the projections show 22%. Reduction. So again, just over halfway there, and that means we really need to be doing a lot better at getting carbon emissions out of our homes. So that's things like retrofitting, installing heat pumps, and moving away from fossil fuel power systems at home.
Now, the government will say we're making progress on this. It might have been slow up to now, but the new climate action plan will drive this agenda on. Do you accept that the change is coming?
Well, so change is coming, and the government is not doing nothing. And so it is now obligated to produce a climate action plan each year. And the latest one came out fairly recently. But the thing to bear in mind is that these projections published today, they assume that everything in the climate action plan, or nearly everything in the climate action plan, will be implemented to the full extent possible. So what these projections today are telling us is that even if the government follows through on every last item that it has promised in the climate action plan, we're still only going to be getting less than halfway there. So really what we need is a better implementation of what the government is trying to do and has said it will do, but also a new suite of policies and measures.
We are so screwed, aren't we? That's Dermot Tourney, director of the DCU Centre for Climate and Society, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about Ireland missing its mandatory emissions targets, even if it implements its own climate action plan in full, something it's not currently doing. Wow. On this afternoon's Liveline, Joe Duffy had a long conversation with Dr. Ali Al-Najjar, a member of the Sligo medical community. Last Friday, an Israeli airstrike hit the home of Dr. Al-Najjar's sister, Dr. Ala Al-Najjar, a paediatrician, and her husband in Gaza. 9 of the couple's 10 children were killed in the airstrike. Here's some of Joe and Dr. Najjar's conversation from this afternoon.
Every day since this crazy war have started, my heart has been probably displaced from where it used to be. I mean, you are always connected to the media and watching the news every minute, just hoping that you won't be reading about one of your relatives. Like, I mean, every life that has been lost is related to me. We are all human beings at the end. I named my son Adam because we all belong to the same man. That's my message. Well, that was my message from naming Adam as Adam, because we are all the same. We are all human beings at the end of the days. And the lives of those 9 children is not more precious than anyone else that has been lost during this madness. All of those 50,000+ lives that have been lost, they all deserve shedding light on them. We are not different than them. I mean, as I said earlier, just the experience of continuously looking at the screen to read about what's going on, because you are always afraid that this moment might come. And unfortunately, on Friday, I read about the loss of my nephews and nieces, mostly from the media. I came across the news between the family group that we have on WhatsApp, and you marry that with what you can read. I became like a mad person just trying to look for any information that I can come across from the Telegram news channels that I regularly follow. I mean the channel of, let's say, Khan Yunus, the city of where Ala has been targeted. It's in the southern part of Gaza Strip. So I follow those different channels. And unfortunately, I did have news about what's going on. Actually, before that event happened, I don't know if you want us to start from how did I came across.
You know what I'd like to do, just because of what you said has prompted me, Dr. Ali, is to name the nine, your nine nephews and nieces, and to think of them. I want our listeners to think of them, and I want to add a few words. So would you be kind enough to call out their names, please?
Yeah, they were... Yahya is the oldest. I'll start from the oldest to the youngest.
Okay.
So Yahya, which is the equivalent Arab name of John. So Yahya, Adam is the second one.
Okay.
Rakan, Eve, Jobran, Raslan, Rival, Sadin, Luqman, and the last, and lastly, the twins, Sidra and Sidar. So they are 11 in total. One of them was lost 3 months ago. She was 3 months old at that time. They were twin. So the last two names I mentioned, they were twin, born on the 14th of October, 24. Okay. So one of them died 3 months after she was born due to infection and lack of medicine have contributed to the loss. The remaining twin, unfortunately, is one of the two bodies that so far their bodies are still under the rubble.
And before this indescribable tragedy, Dr. Ali, had your sister Alaa spoken to you about her fears for the safety of herself and her family?
Of course, every now and then, whenever we have the chance to talk, of course, with all difficulties in getting through communication, I mean, lots of difficulties. I don't want to expand more about lack of electricity, lack of internet, and how do we hear about them. It's a story by itself. But the last time we spoke before this tragedy happened, 3 weeks ago, when one of my sisters lives in Vancouver, she was visiting me in Sligo. I remember both of us were driving the car. We were parking the car in the parking area of Nukunaria Forest Walk.
Okay.
So we were parking there on the Bluetooth of the car. We were both listening to Alaa while she was talking to both of us. And she was describing how life is like while she walk among the rubbles. And she usually walks while her eyes are staring at the sky. Because every building she looks at carries out its own special memory. And all that you'll be looking at is rubble, dismantled, destroyed houses, buildings. Where will you have memory about with every single thing that you see around you, and the reality now has been completely dismantled. So for her, I remember specifically she said, "I don't know what life is about at your side, but we believe that we are already experiencing what doomsday is." So every moment she tells me, when I meet or greet anyone in the street, we'll be always saying farewell, goodbye. We never know when we are going to meet again, because everybody is expecting his moment at any time. Yeah. You know, they're just on the waiting list, kind of, you know. When she talks, I talk to her about how can you reassure your kids and how are they coping with the situation? And she says, of course, it's the hardest job for me to do now, is how to keep them reassured. Kids are resilient. I mean, you can't comprehend. I can hardly understand how can they. They are more resilient than ourselves, by the way. But of course, they are affected the most by the tragedy, hearing the bombs. How can they sleep at night with all the air striking, which is usually intensified during the nighttime? Mm-hmm. And so my daughter keeps telling them, well, whatever happened is meant to happen. She's strengthening their belief in faith. Mm-hmm. Whatever happened, if we are gone, we are gone to heaven. We belong to God. The injustice that we are seeing is not because of anything that we have done.
That's some of the conversation Joe Duffy had with Dr. Ali Al-Najjar on this afternoon's Liveline about the appalling conflict in Gaza and Dr. Al-Najjar's 9 nephews and nieces who were killed in an Israeli airstrike last Friday. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, Claire Byrne convened her Waterford librarians, Jenny Loughran and Tracy McEnany, this morning to talk about good audiobooks for the summer. Here's a few of their recommendations.
Jenny, speaking of famous actors, you're recommending Her Majesty's Royal Coven by Juno Dawson. This is read by our own Nicola Coughlan.
Read by Nicola Coughlan, and she's a fabulous narrator. We know she's a brilliant actress, but she's a fabulous narrator. So Juno Dawson, she's a best-selling author who's written fiction and non-fiction books for young adults, and this is her foray into the adult world. So kind of a lot of times you have adult writers going the opposite way, but Juno Dawson wrote for young adults. And Her Majesty's Royal Coven follows a top-secret government department of witches, you know, this is my bag. This is what I like.
You love this,
yeah. And there's a threat to the nation. Whisperings of a prophecy. The coven is going to be brought to his knees, and it's all about friendship and life as a witch was never simple, and now it's about to get apocalyptic. So there's 3 books in this series. I've listened to the first 2, which is Her Majesty's Royal Coven and The Shadow Cabinet, and my next listen, I'm going to listen to the 3rd book, Queen Bee. I've just literally downloaded it from Borrowbox, but the best part, Nicola Coughlan's narration is fabulous.
I bet.
Really, really good.
You see, there you
really
go. It makes it. Tracy, I'm going to ask you to come to The Inheritance. This is about a family reunion on a remote island that takes a dark twist. I already love it.
It's fantastic. This was recommended by a library customer. I read it. It's 10 hours, 39 minutes long. No audiobook should be over 11 hours. That's, I think, to me. It's a family reunion. It ends in a murder. The Argyvals are gathering at a family reunion on a remote island off the west coast of Scotland. The murder actually happens at the start of the book. You don't know who's murdered and you don't know who the murderer is. It's a story of a rich family who will stop at nothing to protect their own. And family is everything. The family are expecting their father to retire. He's going to sell their multi-million company and divide up their inheritance. They all need the money. Myra, the eldest daughter, she owns the island but is in financial difficulty. So the inheritance will help with that. You've got Asim, who's the son. He wants the inheritance to start up his own business. He's married to Zoe, his influencer wife. And then you've got Aisha. She is the wild child who spends the money and has all the unsuitable boyfriends, and the unsuitable boyfriend is currently on the island. This book will keep you guessing until the end. Lots of family secrets revealed along the way, but a really good book.
So remind us again, it's called The Inheritance
by Tricia Zakalecki.
Right, okay, that sounds great. That's sold. We're into that. Now, we're going to a classic next, Jenny, Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh, but this is read by Jeremy Irons.
Read by Jeremy Irons. Of course, he also starred in the famous television adaptation, and the version I listened to was on CD. I borrowed it on CD. My car is old enough to have a CD player. I'm old enough still to have a CD player, and it was recommended to me by a book group I'm in. I would never have thought of it. And it's a classic tale. We know it's got love, fate, loss. The character Charles Ryder, he meets up this aristocratic family, and the fading world set between the two world wars. But Jeremy Irons reading the audiobook, his voice is really reflective, but he's so measured and he's so poetic. It's
well,
just sounds wonderful
like
to listen to.
A classic treat.
Yeah, and obviously I knew the storyline. I've read that book years ago. I've seen the TV show, but it was recommended to me a few weeks ago and I said, you know what? And there, lo and behold, had it on CD. Wonderful to listen to.
Your next pick. When I saw this last night, I downloaded it straight away. Tom Lake.
Tom Lake by Anne Patchett, but narrated in the audiobook version by Meryl Streep.
I cannot wait. I'm going to start it today.
So, like, it's, you know, Meryl Streep's writing paired with, oh, sorry, beg your pardon, Anne Patchett's writing paired with Meryl Streep's narration. And if I had looked at the book version of this before, and it's set in the beginning of 2020. And it's a family who are brought together because of the circumstances that we're all under 2020. And I was like, nah, that's not for me, not right now.
Sometimes then, that can be a turn off. Yeah.
But then I said, oh no, this audiobook's narrated by Meryl Streep and it's fantastic. So it's set in America. You have this woman, Lara, her daughters all return to the family home in Northern Michigan, and they start asking her about her past. Before they were born, their mother had been in a theatre company called the Tom Lake Theatre. That's where the title of the book comes from. And she'd had a romance and shared a stage with a famous actor. And of course, she's recalling her past, and her daughters have to examine their own lives and reconsider the world as they thought they knew it. But yeah, narrated by Meryl Streep. And we've since found out that, I haven't heard it yet, but there's a version of Charlotte's Web, the classic children's story, out there somewhere narrated by Meryl Streep. So that's, we're going hunting for that
right,
one
we'll
now.
Go down the Meryl Streep road.
Yeah.
Now, Tracy, next up, you describe this one as creepy but brilliant. It's called Beautiful Ugly by Alice Feeney.
Alice Feeney is known for psychological thriller. She's written 7 books. It's read by Richard Armitage and Tuppence Middleton.
Isn't he also an author, Richard Armitage?
Yes, I think he is.
He's
actually a very good narrator,
yeah.
Absolutely. It's 9 hours, 23 minutes long. The author, Grady Green, has just found out his book is a bestseller. So it's the best day of his life, but it actually turns out to be the worst day of his life. The wife is driving home on the coast road, and he's speaking to her on the speakerphone. She finds a body in the road. She says to Grady, oh, I'm just going to go out and see if the person is okay or what happened, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he says, oh, keep me on speaker. And he says, like, he was trying to convince her not to go out. She goes out, and that's the last, as you see, of Abby, his wife. Now, it's a year later, and the godmother of Abby is actually Grady's agent. Now, he can't write. He's, mm-hmm. you know, he's got writer's block. So she sends him off to another remote Scottish island who used to belong to a writer who died a couple of years ago. But only 25 inhabitants on this island. They're all a bit strange. There's a cliffhanger at the end of every chapter. It's absolutely brilliant.
Sounds great.
Oh, brilliant.
And you've another one now, which you say is a little bit different. Lula Dean's Little Library of Banned Books.
This is read by January Lavoie. Now, she is one of those. Jeremy Irons, I think, was number 5 on the best narrators, but she's up there on the top 20. It's set in Troy, Georgia. Everyone is frightened of Lula Dean. She's decided that the books in the school library and the public library are not suitable for the town. So thanks to the like-minded people, she's able to remove all the unsuitable books in the library and set up her own library outside her house with the suitable books that she deems suitable. She's not a reader. She buys them from the second-hand shop, mm-hmm. 50 cents. So you can imagine.
A very current theme all of this
yes,
in the United States.
Yes. In the middle of the night, a couple of people come along with a suitcase of the banned books and swap the dust covers. So the banned books are now in the library, but people think they're the suitable books. But it's a book about the people who want to fight back for what they believe in, the right to be a little bit different. I just love this book. It's and was recommended by Anne-Marie in Browns Road Library.
Just some of the terrific audiobook recommendations for summer listening from Tracy McEnany and Jenny Loughran, Clare's Waterford Librarians, this morning. And that's all I have for you on this last Wednesday in May edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And The Mothership, that'd be Playback, is on the air and in podcast land every Saturday with an altogether crisper, cleaner, cleverer look back at an entire week in radio. But for me, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.